This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. When the National League was formed in the 1870s, baseball went from being a sport run by the players to a sport run by the businessmen who owned the teams. Over the next decade, those businessmen realized that competing to sign players was bad for business. They introduced the Reserve Clause. Players wouldn't successfully challenge the Reserve Clause until 1975, but they came close once before in 1890. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Earlier this year, in March, Joe Tomasulo, the East Coast consignment director for the sports memorabilia auction house Memory Lane, was in White Plains, New York for a trade show.
It's the JPRS, Rock Solid Sports Show.
That's Joe. He set up his table near the front door of the convention center. It's his usual spot.
A gentleman walked in with his wife with an accordion file, said he wanted to show me some rare documents that he's held for many years.
Joe won't tell me the names of the gentleman and his wife. Like most of Joe's consigners, they've chosen to remain anonymous for reasons that are also undisclosed.
I'm being very vague here, but I think you get the point. It's a privacy issue.
What Joe will say is that the gentleman is a retired contractor, and he acquired the documents on the job sometime in the mid-90s.
They were unearthed from a desolate New York office building, upstate New York. The wooden floors were termite-ridden, so they basically had to replace the floors with cement. There was a particular storage room with a bunch of boxes. So he just went directly to the owner of the building. What do I do with this stuff? He told them to keep it, throw it out, do whatever you want. Just get rid of it. So he didn't have the time to go through all these boxes. He just took what he thought was interesting.
And the rest went into the trash.
Correct. God knows how many historical signatures, documents were thrown away. Sad.
Joe started thumbing through the documents.
And I'm seeing John Ward's name and Tim Keefe and Buck Ewing.
These names were familiar to Joe Tomasulo. They're very early Hall of Famers and some of the most sought-after autographs in the baseball world.
This is a point I can't stress enough. There's a handful of those Hall of Fame signatures currently existing in the hobby. A couple of Keefs, a couple of Ewings, maybe a few more Ward, maybe four or five Wards. All I'm thinking to myself is, this is a dream. This is an autograph collector's dream.
But Joe noticed something else about these documents. The team names were from the 1890 Players League. Joe had heard of the Players League before, but in all of his decades working in the hobby, he had never come across documents like these. He's seen a couple of baseball cards, but that's it.
They're basically unique.
As Joe was thumbing through the pile, he came across one particular document, a single piece of paper dated February 2nd, 1891, and signed by four shareholders of one of these Players League teams.
I'm thinking to myself, the Queen Mary has pulled in.
Joe's excitement is monetary. He believes that document to be worth a lot of money. But I'm fascinated by it because of what it represents. Let's explain.
So going back to 1889, to make it simple, players back then were treated like mere sheep.
They were held to what was called the Reserve Clause, which meant that every season your contract would expire and your team would offer you a new contract and you could either sign the contract or you would be banned from baseball.
That's W.M. Akers.
I write about baseball history and I also write fiction.
And this story, the story of the 1890 Players League, reads like a work of fiction. Because in the late 1800s, owners had all the control, and they knew it. They could pay the players whatever they wanted, fine them for anything, literally anything.
There was one team that was almost insolvent, and so the owner started fining the players for every loss. And by the end of the season, he'd fine them so much that he was able to recoup their entire salaries.
And then along came John Montgomery Ward.
He's the only man in history to collect 100 wins and 2,000 hits.
Ward wasn't just a great player. He was also a really smart guy. He studied law at Columbia. And in 1885, he founded a secret society. He called it the Brotherhood of Professional Baseball Players.
It's what today we would call a labor union, although they were very, very careful to avoid using that term because it was pretty incendiary.
Within a year, 90% of the National League players had joined, and the Brotherhood went public.
Ward's big target was the reserve clause, and he wanted to give his players the right to negotiate freely with what we would today call free agency.
The owners were wary of the Brotherhood, at least at first. They made a few concessions, but then took them back. Ward needed a way to get close to one of the owners, to bend his ear. After the 1888 season, A.G. Spalding, owner of the franchise in Chicago, arranged for an around-the-world baseball barnstorming tour to spread the love of the game and sell sporting goods. Ward saw an opportunity.
He felt like maybe if Spalding and I are alone on a boat for several weeks, maybe I can talk to him, I can show him that, hey, the reserve clause is not good for us or for you. Let's move this game into the future together.
So Spalding and Ward boarded a ship bound for Hawaii, Australia, then Cairo, Paris, and London. But
3 days after they set sail, the National League enacted what was called the Brush Classification Plan.
The Brush Plan was essentially a salary cap. Players were graded from A to E. Top players were grade A, and under this plan, they would make $2,500, which was half of what they'd earned the year before. Grade E players would make just $1,500, and
if the owners wanted to, they could force a grade E player to sweep the ballpark. That was very important to them.
News of the Brush Plan didn't reach John Montgomery Ward until months later, when Spalding's barnstorming tour reached Cairo. And if Ward was upset, he didn't let the press know.
Basically, he refused to comment. He sort of bided his time.
When the tour reached Paris, Ward headed back to New York, telling Spalding and the press that he had some personal business to attend to.
This was not a lie. He was married to a Broadway actress, and his marriage was kind of falling apart. In addition, he went home to try to deal with his union and this salary cap.
The Brotherhood was furious. Many wanted to call for an immediate strike.
Ward would say, let's not do anything yet, let's not do anything yet, let's not do anything yet.
What Ward didn't say, at least at first, was that he had a much bigger plan to take down the reserve clause.
Rather than do like a one-off strike right now, which would really just poison the fans against him, he wanted to get together enough money to actually start an entire independent baseball league.
So every time Ward's team went on a road trip, he'd meet with investors in major league cities. His pitch was simple. How'd you like to own a baseball team? Turns out there was plenty of interest.
So on July 14th, which is happily Bastille Day, they voted on a secret manifesto to declare, quote, we have determined to play next season under different management.
But news of their secret manifesto leaked out, and soon everyone knew what was about to be announced.
So it's November 4th, 1889, and the players get together at the Fifth Avenue Hotel, which was the deluxe Manhattan Society Hotel. And this is sort of, in some ways, the high point of the entire experiment, because this is when the players, after years and years and years of getting kicked around by ownership, really get to thumb their noses at them and say, that's it, you're not going to hire us for your league, we don't care, we're done.
King Kelly, a slugger for Boston, showed up, according to newspaper reports, wearing a tight-fitting pair of imported trousers, a tall silk hat, and a beaver overcoat. He stopped to talk to the press outside the hotel and taunted the owners of his former team by saying,
listen, if you want a job next season, I'll give you a job taking tickets at the turnstiles. And then he tells the reporters, goodbye, I'm going inside to manipulate the wires that will startle the baseball world.
Was that just bravado, or did these guys really think that this thing was going to work?
I think they did think that it was going to work, and I wouldn't call it a doomed experiment from the start. I think that there was a very, very good chance that the Players League could have succeeded, mainly because more than half of the players in the National League jumped ship, and most of the top players came, including guys like Buck Ewing, Monty Ward, Tim Keefe.
The Players League placed most of its teams in major cities, where a National League team was already playing.
And I think that if things had broken the other way, we could be watching Players League baseball every week instead of National League baseball.
But things didn't break the other way. To field competitive teams, both leagues poached players from a third league playing baseball in 1890, the American Association.
You had three baseball leagues going, and none of them could field a really top-notch team, so it was sort of like there was too much baseball, and most of it wasn't very good.
The American Association folded. The Players League might have made it back for the 1891 season if not for Buck Ewing, the player manager of the New York team.
Both of the New York clubs were suffering, so the Giants have a secret meeting with Ewing after the season ends, and they say, listen, this is bad for all of us. Why don't you just quit?
And that's just what Ewing did. The two New York teams announced that they would merge and play in the National League. Soon, the other clubs followed suit.
It fell apart extremely quickly.
Much of this story is told through the documents unearthed in that upstate New York office building, from the unsigned draft of the league's constitution to the bill authorized for payment by John Montgomery Ward for the printing of 400 player contracts. But then there's Joe Tomasulo's Queen Mary, the letter signed by stockholders he's hoping will fetch the highest price in Memory Lane's upcoming auction. That one was signed by future Hall of Famers Buck Ewing and Tim Keefe on February 2nd, 1891. In it, Ewing and Keefe call for a meeting to discuss paying off the team's debts and acknowledge, as shareholders, that those funds would most likely come out of their own pockets. But WM Akers says that wasn't the worst part.
As soon as the Players League died and then the American Association followed soon after, owners responded by taking full advantage of the reserve clause to slash salaries.
It didn't work out for the Players League, but it just might work out for that retired contractor and his wife, though Joe Tomasulo didn't tell them that right away.
You know, you don't want to shoot for the moon right out of the gate.
Joe says the document signed by John Montgomery Ward will likely go for $15,000 to $20,000. Tim Keefe and Buck Ewing's signatures are worth more, maybe $25,000 to $50,000. But what about the Queen Mary, that letter signed by both Keefe and Ewing?
I couldn't even begin to put a price tag on it. I will say this, I would be disappointed if it fell anything less than six figures.
The consigners, that retired contractor and his wife, would probably be disappointed too. Did the consigners tell you at all what they planned to do with the money?
No. Other than, I think he had mentioned a couple of new kitchen utensils. They're redoing their kitchen. But other than that, no.
That's Joe Tomasulo speaking with Only a Game's Karen Given. We'll have links to Memory Lane's auction, which opens on December 22nd, and WM Akers baseball dice game Dead Ball at onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.